Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. This evening we are going to be discussing a subject matter that for many of you, it would be a very difficult one. I have to tell you that in reading this material, the book called Straight Jackets and Lunch Money, it was really an exposure to an environment that some children experience. And it was, in my view, a tough read. Now, the reason it's important that this book and the stories that it contains is important is because sometimes it's very, very difficult for a child to be able to express themselves, to even know how to express themselves. Katya Sengel is a woman who at the age of 10 ended up becoming a patient at a Roth psychosomatic unit at Children's Hospital in Stanford. Now, this was in 1986, 10 years old. She was one of the youngest there. Most of the children were a bit older than her, but a lot of things went on. But the story that she's trying to get across is that children do have a voice, but so often it is very difficult when they've gone through traumas to be able to really, well, how can I say this? Be willing to try to learn how to listen and to observe. Katya Sengel, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Katya, you are a mature woman right now. You are actually a journalist. You did something that I would have wanted to do if I had been in your shoes. I probably would have said, enough is enough. The past is where it is, and I'm going to move on. I don't want to go back and revisit it. Yet you did. You went back to the very environment that you had been captured in. What was it? How many months were you there?
It was more than 100 days, so it was more than 3 months.
Wow. So that changed your life in such an amazing way, but you bring out so many facts about what you observed, what you did. There had to be something that you were seeking, that you were wanting to find. What was it?
I think it was still, I guess when things happen when you're young like that, it's something that really you feel more than things that have happened as I'm older, because it's your formative years. And it really did kind of shape the rest of my life in many ways. I think in journalism, I've always tried to tell stories about people I feel like don't have as much of a voice. And I had felt at that time as a child, I wasn't being listened to and I didn't have as much of a voice. And I think I really always want to highlight those people, those groups, and had always really wanted to work with kids like that as well. I tried volunteering at similar hospitals before, but I wasn't allowed to visit. And so I think it just was something that kind of had been with me all this time. And so I thought, you know, I want to learn more about the methods used with kids like this and like what exactly happened when I was there. What was the reasoning behind the treatment? And then what happens with kids like that now? I guess I still felt like there were too many unknowns and that I needed to still give voice to those kids who I felt were a little bit shut away from society. People didn't really want to listen to us or see us, and I wanted to make people listen and see.
Mm-hmm. I think it is very, very difficult for anyone dealing with any level of mental illness, to really understand what it is, because in some instances, the brain is just wired differently. We like to pat ourselves on the back because of all the technologies that we have today. But this was 30 years ago for you, and things were quite different then, but not necessarily all that much. The world we're in today, we have just these numbers of people, especially young people, that are really suffering levels of mental illness. And you're being 10 years old. And the fact that you have not blocked out of a lot of this, your writing and your story about what your family was like, your dad, he's still alive. Is your mom still alive?
Yes.
Okay, so both of your parents are still alive. But there was so much going on in your environment because your parents divorced and you were with your father as well as your mother going between the two. And that would be, you know, divorce in families often is very traumatic. And when you're 10 years old, you really cannot see the world very well. You just can't. It's, you don't have any experience to rely on. And for you, you stopped eating. And when I was reading about how much weight you lost and your candor in expressing how you felt, my goodness, that was really pretty intense to read.
Yeah, and I think that's where the lunch money and the title comes from, because I stopped eating when I was 9 years old. So it's prepubescent, so they don't categorize that as anorexia, and it really wasn't. It was just the only way I saw to show people my unhappiness and that I needed an escape route. It was interesting when I went back and interviewed the doctors who treated me and treat children like that. They had said they specifically don't like to give diagnosis to children that young, because then they just try and meet those expectations and live up to that diagnosis. And they say, you know, prepubescent, it's so hard to diagnose. So I had like a deferred diagnosis or something. But the lunch money comes back to, so the idea was my dad was very depressed and unemployed and always short of money. And so I decided that to fix it, I would save my lunch money. I got a dollar for lunch every day. I'd save that. And after a while, I'd have enough money. I could give it to him and he'd be happy. And, you know, it's the 10-year-old logic that you could solve the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then slowly no one really stopped me from not eating. So then it became, well, if no one really cares if I eat or don't eat, then maybe I'll cut out breakfast and then dinner. And it was the slow method I used to starve myself that was the reason I actually survived. They said, the doctors, when I was put in the hospital, my heart should have given out earlier, but because I had slowly starved myself, it hadn't. And I think that's why I was able to survive. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it kind of started with that lunch money.
Well, now, with that situation, and I would say your mother had no idea about, all she knew is that you had a chance, you know, to go to the beach with her and your sister, and you refused to go because you felt guilty about leaving your dad. And of course, he was putting a guilt trip on you. I'm going to be alone and all of this other stuff. And so here you are as a 10-year-old. You want him to be happy, but yet at the same time, you were very frightened of your father. And there were all of these, we might want to call them childish observations on your part, which really, that term is correct, because you were thinking like a child, 9, 10 years old. You are thinking like a child. You're not going to think like an adult, for heaven's sakes. That's not what you're going to do. And so when I'm reading through your stories and the emotion and the confusion. And it was as if this was the only thing you really had control over. And when they forced you to be put into this facility, and you were there for over 100 days, my goodness, there were a few people that really had, interestingly enough, it was younger people. And I think of the man, Dan, and then there was, you know, there were some other people as well who were very compassionate and very caring, but you got to be so bad that they had to put a feeding tube into you. And you'd managed to take it out.
Yeah,
you were almost like an incorrigible. They go, what do we do with this girl? And you really were a challenge for them. But you also share in your book the stories of the other young people that were around you. And you were able to make friends. But you weakened so much physically that they really were concerned you were going to die. And one nurse, after you pulled out your feeding tube in one situation, she sat with you. She said, I'm going to have to sit with you all night to make sure that you got nourishment.
Yeah. There were some in the hospital, I think you mentioned Dan. He was, I forget his exact title, but I'd call him a counselor. So you had, mm-hmm. you know, your psychiatrist and your medical doctor assigned to you and such, but you also had two counselors. And I felt like those were the people that I felt safest with, because they were just there. They weren't supposed to do anything for me or to me. They were just there for me, to listen to me, to just be there. And it was really reassuring. They were going to be there no matter what. And the doctors and nurses were a lot scarier because they were putting tubes down you, connecting you to things. And at the time, yeah, I was still fighting it because I didn't want to be alive, really. I didn't want to be fixed because I didn't feel like the underlying problems, no one had listened to me. And I think you were really correct when you said it was the one thing I could control. And so the food was my way to tell people something is wrong, something needs to be done. And then, yeah, if they take that from me, there's nothing in my world I could control. I couldn't control the custody situation where I'm 1 week one house, 1 week another house. I couldn't control my dad's depression. There was nothing I had control over, but I could control food.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what I could do, and I didn't want to give up that control.
Mm-hmm. And the other kids, the girls especially, although there were some boys that were in the facility because of anorexia and or even bulimia, but it's primarily the females that will do this, the girls. And they do it for different reasons. And they were very adept. One girl taught you how to become bulimic. And that's awful, because you can really do serious damage to yourself, anyone that becomes bulimic. That is very, very serious, as is the anorexia. So in a way, they had put a categorization there, but they really did not have the staff to deal with the psychological issues. When you look back at that, when you look back at that time frame, which obviously you've done with a great deal of thoroughness in your publication, Straight Jackets and Lunch Money, when you look back on that in your hindsight, do you think that it would have been different if some people had been trained to be able to read the signs, if you will? I mean, it was so obvious that you didn't like yourself, you didn't like life, you didn't find joy in anything, and you were so deliberate about not eating, and yet at the same time, you really didn't want to die, but yet you did want to die. I mean, here are all of these emotions. You're 10 years old, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the book I have two voices in it. I have that 10-year-old voice who hates the doctors, thinks they're doing everything wrong, and And then I have my adult journalist voice who goes back and hears the reasoning behind the doctors. And so, and as the adult me, I think I wouldn't have known what to do with a 10-year-old like that. It is so hard. And I think they did do the best they could. I think in reality, what I needed, what I wanted was not something they could give me. I think I really wanted my dad to have noticed and to have cared and to have done something.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't happening. So no matter what anyone else did, it wasn't really going to work on some level. And they did keep me alive. I mean, that was in question, you know, for a while there. So I think, it worked, you know, whether everything that was done to me, definitely, I don't know, maybe some things could have been done differently and things, but I think, I don't know what you do with a 10-year-old who doesn't want to be there. It is so hard to communicate with a child like that who is so, and I also have to say I'm incredibly stubborn. And so once I kind of got on that determination, it was really hard to break that. There are some things I think, you know, maybe some different types of therapists might have been better suited for me, and things like that. But then the pairing with Dan was a great, the counselor I got was great. And a lot of the people, they really did care and they were trying. So I don't know. There's in the, but it is true also when you're in a facility for a while, then there's some good things about being around other children who have similar issues. And then there's some bad things in that you start, imitating each other and picking up the bad habits of other people. And especially 'cause I was younger, they were like my big sisters. And so I followed their lead. So, well, I might not have been anorexic when I went in, I was when I went out, because that's who my role models were. So it's a really tricky situation.
When you were finally released, your attitude had changed. What was it like, and who did you end up with? Because your dad was not a person, you know, from the beginning, he needed the therapy himself. He was psychologically, there was a great deal of difficulty he was going through, and that was just part of his package. Where did you go? How did they release you? Why did they release you when they did?
Yeah, originally, one reason was insurance money ran out. And I was medically stable. And so they originally actually did not want to release me to my family. They wanted me, in a kind of group home type setting. But it was full and there was a waiting list. So I was put on the waiting list for that. And in the meantime, I was temporarily released to, my mother, but officially there was still joint custody. So I was released to both my parents, but, my dad didn't really fight it to see me, so I ended up just living with my mom, and she was able to keep my weight stable, and so they did not try to fight her on trying to get me back and put me in the place they had wanted to place me.
Now, obviously, here you are 30 years later as a journalist. You're putting out a book about your life mental illness with children. When you finished this book, I would like to think that you had a sense of release when you were writing it. It must have been really something to be able to retain all of this on a conscious level that you've put into your book and to write it so that other people would read it. But one of the comments you made is that you've always wanted to work with children who have, let's say, a similar patterning to yours. And there's all kinds of things. I mean, you described a young girl who wouldn't eat, and she had a chicken a piece of chicken on her plate, and she goes over and she's washing it and washing it and washing it and washing it. This is obsessive compulsive behavior. And when she was asked why she was doing it, she said, oh, it's got germs on it, it's got bacteria, it's got all kinds of things. And the question you want to ask is, why has this become so obsessive with her? What is it that she's really trying to clean up in her life? And she's just a young girl. So getting into that world, and you knew it so well, do you still, I mean, as a journalist, you're trying to communicate about mental illness with young children, and it does exist. And fortunately, it is not with 50% of the population of kids, but it's still there. And what we've gone through recently with COVID and other scenarios that evolved through that, so many of our young people are experiencing all kinds of depression because the adults weren't handling it very well. So they ended up not handling it very well. And we've got this ripple effect that's going on. Do you still feel that you would like to be able to work in an environment like that, maybe as a volunteer? What do you think it would take to assist young people?
You know, for me, it was a lot of times kind of the people who weren't actual official doctors and those type of people who, it was just knowing some adult cared about me and was there just for me, and especially one that maybe didn't even know me or have any reason they should care about me. And so I've kind of used that and still do, and just try and be there to mentor kids and be there for those who need that, and who to let them know that there are people who care about you. And I think that was a really big thing for me that I always wanted to know, because I blamed kind of my parents for not noticing earlier, but I also blamed the other adults and my world. And I felt, you're an adult, you should do something. And now as an adult myself, I know it's much more complicated, because, you know, if I see something with a child that I think's wrong, it's hard sometimes to interfere because you fear, you know, this, if they get taken by the state, that might not necessarily solve anything. So I understand as an adult, it's much more complicated. But as a kid, that's what I wanted to know, that people cared and were looking out for me. And so I just try and do that I teach journalism at a university, and so I'm around young people there. And then also I do mentoring with a young person. And so that's kind of what I want to do, how I do it. I also had volunteered earlier at a youth detention facility, and it wasn't exactly mental health, but it was the same idea. Kids who, well, a lot of the young people there actually did have mental health issues, or were just kids who felt like no one cared about them, and why would people care? And when they saw just a stranger going there to visit them, it impressed them, because it was like, oh, someone does care about me. I am worth it to this world. And I think that's really the message I want those kids to have, is we do care about them, and you are worth it to society and the world.
Being as young as you were, and being 10 years old, and then when you were released to your mother, when you came out of that environment, obviously they had stabilized you. You had put on some weight. I mean, you had really lost a tremendous amount of weight. More than once, they thought they were going to lose you, that you were going to die, because you were absolutely refusing to take any kind of food in, none whatsoever. And I think you were fortunate that your internal organs were not seriously damaged. But maybe it's because you were 10 years old. You know, your body was more resilient for that. I don't know. But I look at it, here you were, you're 10 when you're finally released, and you have moved in with your mother. How were you able to adapt to your teenage years? Was there a process you went through?
Yeah, I think it was still, and it's not like everything's perfect afterwards. That stays with you. I still struggle with depression, and I haven't my whole adult life. I've been on Zoloft and the few times I've tried to quit have not gone well, to say the least. I have had to take leaves of absences from work, and I have had times I slip. But teenagers were hard. I was very angry, I would say, as a teenager. I did, I think it was around my teen years that I went on Zoloft, and Zoloft helped immensely. I also started actually talking to a therapist. So I had therapy in the hospital, but I didn't really utilize it. I didn't want to talk to a therapist, but by high school, I started actually talking to a therapist. And then for me, sports had helped. So I put my energy into sports. And so I kind of, I was able to eat because it was the fuel I needed to be an athlete. And so I just kind of became a bit obsessive about sports. And you'll see that actually with some people with eating disorders who end up really focusing on exercise or something. And there can be some positives from it. You get the high of the endorphins, those types of things. But then there's some negatives, too, when you get too obsessive or fixated on it.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was helpful, calming as well. But I think the Zoloft was the biggest difference there. But definitely, it was not all fixed all of a sudden. It's something you deal with for life in different ways, but much more healthier than when I was that 10-year-old.
When it comes to the use of medications, with children, it's very, very tough due to their body chemistry and their size, and dependent on their age as well. It's really a challenge, and there's many people in the medical environment that are very cautious about giving narcotic or pharmaceuticals to children without really understanding what's going to be able to assist them. And in our world today, in our medical system, we have cut back so much with the patient-doctor interaction. And this is a big challenge in our world today. What would you like to see changed when it comes to dealing with children that do have mental illnesses like you were describing with yourself? What would you want to see changed?
I would love to see more from what I've heard. So when I was treated, it was a psychosomatic ward. So you treated the medical and the mental together. And we all know those are interlinked, but because of insurance reasons, they're now treated separate mostly. And I think that's a big mistake because it takes time, and they're also treated much faster. You don't stay in the hospital as long as I did. And one might not have needed to stay there quite that long. I think you need a child to be out of whatever environment might be they're having trouble with long enough that they feel safe enough they can actually talk about it and kind of recover from that environment. And you need the time, doctors and therapists who have the time to try and figure out what is going on here, because the kid isn't going to tell you. And it's a puzzle, and it takes quite a lot of time to put together, okay, yes, there are these physical manifestations, but what is going on mentally that is doing this? And I was put, I think I was, they put one antipsychotic medication on me when I was in the hospital, but they stopped it later. And I wasn't on Zoloft until I was late teens or mid-teens at least. And the thing is also with, in some ways I'm really lucky because Zoloft works for me. There are other people who the medications don't work for at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be a very individual thing with medications as well, because some people, they really don't help. And I agree with children. I'm very hesitant to put them on something when you don't know how they personally are going to interact with it and what's going to go. But I think also, I don't know, it's so hard because of the options, but I think really time and attention are the big things I'd like to see with the kids, and looking at the whole picture, mental and physical together.
Mm-hmm. And I think also trying to find out about the family dynamics or what their environment is, because many times there are all kinds of issues that are going on, just like they were with you. And your personality was the type that you swallowed everything. You kept everything to yourself. And this is something that with your mother today, how does she respond to that? Do you sit down and have talks with her? I know your dad is not in that situation now, but where you're interacting with him. But the mother, do you tell her what your feelings were? Have you shared with her what, you know, was going on with you at that time? Has she read your book?
Yeah, actually, my mom and I are very close, and she read it before it was published several times, one to make sure I remembered things accurately, and she's also given me advice on writing. She's actually a really good critic, but then I also keep it. She also knows it's my work, but it's been hard for her, but she was telling me actually in some ways it's actually kind of healing for her too when she sees me up there and I'm healthy and successful or fine and everything, and this is kind of the past a bit. And so it's interesting that she finds it very hard to read, but again, healing in a way because she sees I'm doing well now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I would dare say it. She would go through a lot of things, and there were many things she couldn't have changed. I mean, she was going through her own realities of life, and she did get married again, and there were all kinds of different issues. But I really think it took a lot of courage for you to put it down in black and white. And I think that this is so significant because mental illness, we talk all the time about adults. We talk about the homeless. We talk about so many things. But it's rare when anyone will bring up a commentary about children. And I'll tell you, there was a psychiatrist that I interviewed on one of my television shows, and he said in his research, in working with the homeless, he found a substantial percentage, like 75% or more, had all gone through very traumatic childhoods. And he said once they had, you know, once they got involved in the homeless environment, then it just seemed like it was just that hopelessness that grabbed onto them. And he said it was really tough. It's very difficult for them to break out of the world that they opted to be a part of because they didn't know they had other options. But there was this situation with mental illness, and it started with almost everyone that he interviewed because of what they went through as kids. And that's a huge message. That is really a very, very big message. Your book, Katya Sengel, is just, it's an amazing read, and it is not what I'd call a fun read, but it makes one aware that children really can express themselves in ways that maybe are not always visible to us in a way of balance, but if we can pay attention, we can make a difference in how we work with them. Katya, you have a website, it's your name, and Katya is spelled K-A-T-Y-A, and your last name, Sengel, is C like Charlie, E-N like Nelly, G like George, E-L.com. I want to thank you so much for being my guest. This is a very tough subject to discuss. It's not an easy one, because it really deals with a depth of human experience that can have a big effect on one's life. And look at what you've been able to achieve and accomplish. So you're a very good example for young people today that they have hope, but not only that, look at what you've accomplished by sharing your story with other people. I want to thank you for being my guest.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Donna Sebo. We are saying goodbye to Katya Sengel. And what I would say is be sure to check out her website at Katya, KatyaSengel. We are going to be taking a break here. We'll be back in just a moment. By the way, I am in studio. 253-582-5597 if you'd like to chat with me. We'll be back in just a moment. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, who's coming up on my program this week? We're going to be talking about tomorrow evening, Find Your Joy with Lisa McCourt, and then Chronic Pain Reset. Now, Wednesdays always are a doubleheader, and we are going to, on Warriors for Peace, be talking with Chris Adams, and he is a retired general, and we are going to be talking with him about his latest publication called War is Necessary. Now, when I saw that title, and I've known Chris Adams for a number of years, I thought, what? That's the last thing any of us want to hear. But you know, that was part of a quote, that's right, by Putin, that he stated. And it is, war is necessary. Those are Putin's words. So you're going to find out more about the story behind this book and things that Chris Adams feels is very important to be aware of relative to not just the Russian environment and attitude of its leader, but also the way things are being viewed in many instances by people who are making decisions that perhaps need to think a little bit differently. Anyway, we're going to be talking about that. The Chronic Pain Reset by Dr. Afton Hassett is going to be on the Donna Sebo Show. And then we've got Anthony Moore, coming of age with two different dads and being with them every other weekend. And then Diana Kokoszka, Becoming More. We're going to be discussing that with her. My goodness, this month just seems to be flying by. And, of course, the television shows are being put together, and I have five of my shows up. We finished a filming of one just recently, and that will be up shortly. And that is going to be, interestingly enough, on mental illness and homelessness. So that television show is going to be up on YouTube as soon as my associate can get it up there. And then we are going to be airing the audio of the program on one of my shows. So all of that being said, also don't forget the Authors Showcase, because we have more people that we are going to be putting in there so you can listen directly to their interviews. And I want to also make you aware of the fact that I'm going to be speaking at the Psychic Spectrum on the 25th of October. I will be there, and I will be speaking around 6 o'clock. I'll be their keynote speaker and also doing demonstrations. And I've had someone call me wanting to know if I would be available for many sessions, and the answer is yes. If I've got some filming of another television show that I'm doing on that Wednesday, so if I'm able to get there early, I will be in the Poodle Dog Banquet Room early, but it depending on traffic, because I'm in a studio that's in another city, so it all depends on how that works out. But I definitely would be available after the program is finished. So that's the Poodle Dog in Fife, Washington. And just know that the psychic spectrum also enables people to tune in to the event, and that's via Zoom. And you can go to the Psychic Spectrum website. All of that information is in my newsletter that goes out the first of every month, as well as the links for my television shows, which are in the video section of my website, as well as up on YouTube. So I wanted to give you that information and put it all together. One of the things that I feel is so important, especially with the topic that we've had this evening, and I know it's a rather heavy topic, but sometimes we have to be able to understand there is not anyone that isn't affected in one way or another. I know, because I've been there, with a depression. Sometimes life throws at us some just absolutely awful situations, and I really don't care what your age is, it's dealing with that. And that's what you call resilience. And resilience is not developed because you say a mantra. Resilience is developed because of living life. And that is something that my mentor taught me when I was in my early 20s and I had the opportunity to interact with her. She had seen a lot of things in her life, and there were so many different issues that she had gone through. But she was able to be an example for me. And one of the things that she would say is, all right, Donna, you have this situation that's going on. You're so apprehensive about this, that, or the other. What's the worst thing that could happen to you? And boy, I could dish it out. Oh, this is what can happen, and this is blah, blah, blah. And I'd go on and on and on, and she would just listen. And she'd look at me, and she said, well, that's not going to happen. So now what are your options? And I can remember sitting there going, what? What do you mean? That's not going to happen. You don't know that that's not going to happen. Our minds will take us in directions. And it just, a lot of it has to do with indoctrination. Depending on who we've been with, what systems we've been exposed to, we buy into so many things. And to learn how to think independently. Now, my guest was 10 years old when she was going through all kinds of different scenarios. And she didn't have anybody that she could talk to. She didn't have anybody she could talk to. And so consequently, as a 10-year-old, her mind went into all kinds of fabrications, which is normal. Adults do that all the time. And the thing is, when, as adults, we can recognize we are in charge of being a master of how we think. Does it work 24/7? It can, but all of us are fallible. All of us are going to have those down moments where we just think, oh, life really sucks all the way down the line. Oh, this is terrible. And we go into that thinking process. But if we're fortunate and we are mature enough to say, now, wait a minute, just as my mentor would say, what's the worst case scenario? Sit down, write it out. Talk it out with someone. Just let it, you know, just let it flow. And then stand back and say, all right, this is what I see as the worst case scenario. What are my options? Is there someone that I can reach out to that maybe can tell me some options? Maybe they can't. But it is that willingness to continue to ask questions and to seek answers. It is a very challenging thing to do. But I can tell you from personal experience, it's when you start asking questions and when you start reaching out, saying, I need to get some answers. Life is not a perfect scenario. I don't care what anybody tries to sell you. You're going to have your ups. You're going to have your downs. You're going to have your failures. You're going to have your successes. It takes work. There's no shortcuts. I haven't found any. Believe me, I tried. And what I found is that I had to come to know myself. I had to come to be able to say, wait a minute, where am I going with this? even in conversations with people. Why am I buying into what somebody else is saying? What are the facts? What's going on? There is that part of you that has to grow in to that level of self-awareness and self-confidence. It really does make a difference. It is work. And like I said, I have been through a number of scenarios in my life, good, bad, and ugly. And it's so important to recognize that we're the ones that give that energy that can deplete us to what it is we don't want, instead of giving energy to what it is we really do want. And that is a discipline of type. I wanted to share something with you, and it has to do with a skill that I just have such an appreciation for. And it is about a man by the name of Hugh Morrison. Now, if you watched, you know, the program Bones. Oh, I just loved that show. I loved the scientific aspect of it. I loved the interaction with the different characters, including the character that would do the reconstruction of face, bodies, use the computer simulation. All of that technical stuff was incorporated in. But she was able to bring people to life via knowing the science of how to do facial construction. Well, I have in front of me an article by Ted Scheinman, and what has been done because of the advancement of technology is when they have a skull, then they will be able to reconstruct that skull. Now, that's been going on for a long time. There are many people that are very skilled in that, and he had an assignment given to him, Hugh Morrison did, and it was quite a challenge. Now, his background, he's Scottish, and he actually lives in Thailand right now, but he's a freelance forensic artist. And if you have anybody that you know of that loves art and would love to get into this, I just think this is an amazing career to have. And he works with police as well as private investigators because he reconstructs faces of victims, and all he has to work with is a skull. And he works with archaeologists as well. Now, one of the things that was given to him was a particular project. And he has a lot of training in the drafting and digital art that he acquired through various educational environments. And he found that this assignment that he was given was really a unique one because it was the first pregnant mummy. Yes, you're hearing me correctly. The very first pregnant mummy to be found in Egypt. And they're finding more and more mummies. But this one was a young woman. She actually was a teenager from the 7th century AD. And they called her the Trumpington Girl. And she was uncovered in England in 2012. Now, they did it. And they found that the girl who had been moved to continental Europe, they found that her diet had changed. This is how good forensics has evolved, and it's going to get better even as the years go by. And they worked out an ancient DNA analysis, and he was able to reconstruct her face. And he said, when it came to her eyes and her hair, there wasn't anything that was left of that. But he said, I had to use my own imagination. So he ended up, because it was determined that this young woman was a European Caucasian classification. And he said he used brown eyes and brown hair for her. And she came alive. He said, it's so important to not let any outside influences get in the way of precision and accuracy. And he said, whether it's a historical or a forensic case, he said, I don't look at any other images related to my task because I totally focus 100% on what is in front of me. And I think that is such an amazing an amazing skill and a talent that is, well, it's not that common. And with computer technology, my goodness, what they're able to do today, it is really fascinating. So if you're looking for a career and you're artistic, why not think of the forensic area? You'd never be bored, that's for sure. A lot of things would come to your attention that you might never expect. And I really think that that's quite significant. Well, I don't know about anybody else, but here in the Seattle area, after COVID ended, then we went back to our heavy traffic. And commuting is just a fact of life. And people will fuss about it. But there are so many ways you can commute. I've got a friend that had to work in Seattle, and he lives south of Seattle. And drive time is typically an hour, maybe even more, depending on whether an accident has occurred or not. Because we have thousands of people out on the freeways going to and from work, doing errands, whatever. We love our cars, and hey, I wouldn't give mine up. Mm-mm, no way. But it is something that commuting, many people use commuting in a different way. And my friend who was commuting into Seattle, he would catch the bus that would take him into Seattle, but then there was a train that enabled him to go to Seattle. He said, I just take a good book, and he said, I take my journal, and maybe I want to write. But he said, I just chill out. It is so nice. I am just able to relax from the tensions of the day. So he said, I'm not stressed at all because I am not driving. And that is something I think that is worthy of noting. It's our attitude about what we're doing. And I know that for many, many years, when I was doing quite a bit of commuting, I would use an audio tape. Today we have CDs. You know, you'd use whatever you could so you could listen to it while you were driving for hours, going from one point to another, which I was doing in the past quite frequently. I don't do it so much anymore. But you don't need to feel like you're burning out. It actually can be a way of refreshing yourself. And I know most people want to cut down commuting time to and from a job, but it's an in-between time that really can assist you to unwind. And if you use it in the right way, you're just going to find that there is that state of mind of relaxation that really is optimum. And like this friend of mine that's ended up, instead of taking the bus, which took him even longer time, he took the train, which was a little bit shorter. But he said, it's all in your attitude, and it really can make a difference. Also, there is something about, what do I want to say, procrastination? Oh, boy, I sometimes have to battle with that one because there are so many things I can get sidetracked into. Are you familiar with that? Oh, boy, that happens to me so many times. Well, they found in doing some research, and this was done in Sweden, 3,500 students were evaluated, and they did this over a nine-month period. And they said those people who habitually delayed important tasks usually experienced more anxiety and depression, poor sleep. They would have pain in their neck and their shoulders, different parts of their body. However, when you can say, wait a minute, this is what I need to take care of. This is first and foremost. I'm going to do this first and delay whatever else I'm wanting to get sidetracked into. When you can develop that different habit and go into that discipline, hey, it works. And you know what I have found that I've done? I actually will take my telephone because sometimes I will have so many phone calls that will interrupt me if I'm working on a task or preparing for something. And I just say to myself, it can go to voicemail. I will return their call. It's that simple. It's making it okay not to pick up the phone. And so many people have that phone on. As soon as it rings, boom, they're right on it. It's okay to let it ring. If you're in the middle of something and you need to complete it, it's just it's the very reason why they tell you when you go into meetings or into theaters or whatever, turn off the phone. Turn it off. Just leave it alone. You're going to be okay. You're going to survive. I know that for a fact. So sometimes we just have to do a little something to enable us to accomplish those important tasks that we really need to give our time and attention to. And I can raise my hand and talk about the times that I've procrastinated, and then I get all upset or I get all anxious, and I go, oh my goodness, I should have done this, and I'll go through that nonsense. Nah. Sometimes it's just unlearning a bad habit and replacing it with a better one. That's something my mentor taught me many years ago. She said, nature abhors a void. And when you're trying to change a pattern, you're trying to change a habit, you need to replace that habit with something that's positive. If you have a bad habit of any kind and you're aware of that bad habit and you want to do something differently, you have to determine that you will do to fill that void. Then when you remove the patterning for the one habit, you replace it with something else that is more positive. And that's why so many people, they will start a certain program and they haven't developed the habit that they want to replace with something that is going to be just as consistent until they have rewired themselves. That's the way I like to describe it. How to rewire the self. It really does, you know, it really does make a difference. Makes a big difference. And since we were talking about kids, there is a commentary that was made by Dorothy Nolte, and she was saying with kids, if kids live with criticism, they learn to condemn. If they live with hostility, they learn to fight. If they live with fear, they learn to be apprehensive. If they live with pity, they learn to feel sorry for themselves. If they live with ridicule, they learn to be shy. If they live with jealousy, they learn what envy is. If they live with shame, they learn to feel guilty. If they live with tolerance, they learn to be patient. If they live with encouragement, they learn to be confident. If they live with praise, they learn to appreciate. If they live with approval, they learn to like themselves. If they live with acceptance, they learn to find love in the world. If they live with recognition, they learn to have a goal. If they live with sharing, they learn to be generous. If children live with honesty and fairness, they learn what truth and justice are. If they live with security, they learn to have faith in themselves and in those around them. If they live with friendliness, they learn that the world is a nice place in which to live. If children live with serenity, they learn to have a peace of mind. Dorothy then asked the question, with what are your children living? I would just like to make a different question. With what are you living with? You know, we can change programming that's dished out by other people. We can change that for ourselves as we grow and mature into adults. But that's something we have to know that we can do. And more than anything else, it's being able to recognize that we can learn to do that. We can learn to trust. We can learn to have a sense of joy about life. We can learn to be grateful. We can learn, period. And that is one of the greatest joys in life. One of my greatest joys is being able to spend time with you and to share with you the wonderful people whose paths I cross. The people that have taken the time to write down their story. Because you know what? Their story, in many respects, is our story. Because we all can listen to people and say, I can appreciate what they're sharing. I understand what they're talking about. It really does make a difference. And it teaches you compassion, too. Donna Sebo here. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow evening. Take care. God bless. And know, you are a light that is needed, and I am so glad that you remember to turn it on. Let that inner light of yours shine. You know, a lot of people never learn to even find where their switch is. Take care. God bless. I'll be with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.